Welcome to Soccer Over Gotham, an NWSL podcast covering Gotham FC with your hosts, Ruby and Gary. Now, without any further ado, let's go Gotham. Let's get on to the show. Episode 45 of Soccer Over Gotham. Gotham FC falls once again to the San Diego Wave, this time at home in front of the best crowd of the campaign on Juneteenth and Father's Day. Ruby and I will break down this game and see what we can learn from it. So Gotham FC is at the crossroads and we'll discuss options for this team and propose some solutions. We also have a great interview with the Equalizer's Dan Laletta. But first, Ruby, how are you?
I'm doing amazing, amazing. Another episode here with you guys. But how are you doing, Gary?
Doing fantastic. So finals week for me. So if I seem a bit scatterbrained, you know why. So I enjoyed the interview I had with Dan Laletta. So the fans may remember him as the journalist who, quote, broke the Elise LaHue story. So I got to pick his brain about what it was like balancing being the first versus being right conundrum and breaking news.
Yeah, that was good. He was the first one to say it. And that was a big story.
He was kind of ominous. Because he just put it out that then it was just silence for like a day or two and everyone was speculating on what it meant. And everyone was yelling at him for for like being cryptic and not telling us what was going on. And wow. Yeah, the whole thing was pretty crazy. So I can't wait to rehash that with him. Team news, that Gotham has a new partner. STA is their new academy partner, which is a big deal for women's soccer. And can't wait to see this work grow and grow and grow. And it seems like this team is doing all the right things.
Yeah, definitely. You can seek some talent from there. Maybe we can find the next Mitch Purse or something.
And Ruby and I, it's going to come out next week, but we did an awesome interview with Stephanie Savino of Morris Elites, and she's just a captivating, really cool person. And I can't wait to share her story with you guys. And yeah, so we'll have something for you guys next week as well. So stay tuned. All right, let's get to why we came here for, which is the game recap. Shall we do it?
Let's do it.
All right. So first, what an absolutely gorgeous day it was at RBA. Just perfect weather, light breeze, mid-70s. It's Juneteenth. Cloud Nine is a mini TIFO of the lyrics to Lauryn Hill's song, I Get Out. It was really cool to see them do that. But yeah, what a beautiful day.
Yes. Perfect, perfect, perfect. Like you said, yes, absolutely gorgeous. Gorgeous day for soccer. And Gotham had a nice crowd out there supporting them. The energy was great. And the TIFO was amazing, like always.
7,500, they said, were at the game. It was awesome. The energy in that crowd is just so cool.
Yeah. I tried to get fries after I saw you at halftime, but the lines were insane. So I was like, you know what? I'm going to skip the fries and go back to my seat and watch the game.
Thought you were gonna drown your sorrows in some fries.
Fries and ketchup, I couldn't, but yeah. It's okay. Yeah,
we'll get to that. So the 18, the 4-2-3-1 seems to be Scott's preferred setup. Harris is back in goal. It's good to see that. Back line of Didasco, Krieger, Johnson, and Dorsey. So Torres and Zerboni is the six. Captain Mewis, Monahan, and Purse across the midfield. And Anamanu in the nine. Our best attacking four. Any thoughts on this lineup, Ruby?
So same lineup, except Harris is back. So, but this is the core starting lineup for Scott. Like I've said before, Harris is back. She was out because she had a lower back injury. Glad to see her back. Torres again makes the starting lineup. I like that. And just want to mention that Flores has been cleared and hopefully she'll be back for the next game or so. She's been cleared. That's awesome.
We're going to start running into a lot of games really quickly. So I'm glad to have her back as
depth. We're going to need her. Depth.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. So I'm happy that Johnson gets to start before heading off for her international games. Let's get to this game recap. Let's go over some highlights from this match. Gotham, for the first time in a couple games, doesn't try to press the first 15 minutes. They are patient, try to build out the back. Gotham is building and being very patient. They're being a lot more patient than they were in games past. We'll get to that later. But Torres, who has been pretty good so far, shows her rookie side and gives away one near fatal turnover to where Turnbow hits the far post, and then one fatal turnover where Morgan makes no mistakes. Going forward, there's a lot of right idea, wrong execution. Gotham gets into dangerous spots, but is either not patient enough or not clinical enough. chances are there, but it's just nothing's coming off. Gotham is the better side through 40 minutes of this game. In a pretty good summation of Gotham's season so far, Mewis plays iffy through, and she just hits the post, and then San Diego gets a half chance, and Morgan makes it 2-0. Disappointing way to end the half where Gotham is getting the better of the stats in the play. Your thoughts, Ruby?
Yeah, they started out great, and like you said, they were being patient and everything. And honestly, I don't want to be a Debbie Downer, but I knew it was going to be San Diego's game. I just knew it. In addition to those mistakes that led to San Diego leading the game 2-0, Gotham was not pressuring the ball enough. San Diego had too much time, too much space. They had so much space and time that those balls came perfectly to Morgan. And, you know, she did a great job. Alex Morgan has no mercy for Gotham. If you saw, she just comes straight shooting. She left with a brace this game and hat trick last game against Gotham. She's just beast mode right now.
Yeah. So for the fans, as we mentioned a little bit earlier, I did run into you at halftime. Ruby, you came at me with a list of things we needed to do to get back to this game. I love that you love talking about this team, and you were just ready to start a podcast right there.
Oh my God. I think, yeah, it was nice. It was really nice. We met each other in halftime, but I think we were ready to get in there and start coaching.
Yeah.
Like, let's do this change. Let's try to do this. This is not happening. But no, for real, no. I honestly, I wouldn't want to be a coach. I feel it's too much pressure.
Yeah. Yeah. I was trying to escape my mother at halftime. She's like, why are they doing this? Why are they doing this? Why are they doing that? I'm like, Mom, I'm going to go do something. I
talked this. Went to the bathroom.
Yeah. That's what it's like my whole life growing up. All right. So this is what I'm talking about when I say killer instinct. Two chances, two goals, two strikers' goals. Just ruthless. You know, Ruby, we made that joke that Gotham was giving Morgan gifts last time, but not this time. Morgan earned those goals. No gifts here. Goals like the first one are goals you just kind of just shrug your shoulders at. There's nobody to blame. I mean, possibly Torres for the turnover, but great run off the shoulder. Morgan is on another level. You can only hope to just minimize the damage that she's doing at this point. And also during halftime, Casey Stoney wasn't satisfied with the way the Wave's performance was going, and she said that they wanted to go for more. So coming from a side that seems to be satisfied with just getting one goal, I was a little jealous, I'll admit it. Gotham finally gets the lion's share of possession, 55-45 at half. This is about as good as a half as we've seen from Gotham given the scoreline.
Yeah, that's true. Well, honestly, I don't know what to say because San Diego is such a great team. So I'm not even mad that like Gotham lost. I'm just a little sad at this point. San Diego played well. And like you said, they earned those goals and they deserved those goals.
Second half, I mean, it was a nice moment right before kickoff where Sheridan walks over to Cloud9 and salutes them and gets a little bit of love back. So hashtag once Gotham. It was good to see her in person again. It's been too long. But so Gotham just picks up from where they left off. They get the better of the possession. They're not really threatening and just can't make that final play. They're getting the final passes now, but not the final play. So Torres gets turned over again and Dorsey slips and San Diego gets one more past Harris. Gotham goes to three in the back with Dorsey, Krieger, and Didasco, which is possibly the shortest back line ever put on a pitch. But all the subs added a spark, but we just couldn't get a consolation goal. So, Ruby, any thoughts on this second half?
And just going back to Sheridan for a little bit, it was really nice that she went and say hello. But after the game, she also approached Cloud9 again and said hi to them. I thought that was really nice of her to do that. And like you said, once Gotham, always Gotham. But it felt that, going back to soccer, it felt that halfway through the second half, Gotham got a little sloppy and a little desperate. Especially when San Diego scored that third goal, you could tell they wanted at least one so bad. They wanted at least one goal, but unfortunately it didn't happen for them. And it made me a little sad because I know they deserve to make goals, but it just didn't happen.
Yeah. Yeah, as you pointed out, it's just a lot of the same things in the first half. It was right ideas, just wrong execution. Players are just not able to execute what they want. You can see the ideas in their heads. And as they're playing, I'm putting myself in their heads. And I'm like, okay, that's the right decision there. Somehow the pass is just not getting there. Yeah. Gotham is good enough on the day to get a draw, but it was just not in the cards. So they maintained 55 possession throughout. During the broadcast, Scott mentioned the what ifs. And on that point, he is right. What if at this point, like what if he hits the net and it's 1-1, the way this, it's just the way it goes sometimes.
Yeah, it is. And like you said too, like they had the right ideas, but Yerma, she's such an incredible person and such an incredible player out there. You can even tell she's a rookie by the way she plays. So, yes, I could see what you're saying. Like, yeah, that was the right idea. But then Guillermo was there to block the ball.
Mm-hmm. What are your overall thoughts on this one?
Honestly, not many thoughts about this game. San Diego dominated Gotham away and in their home. They're just a great and well-trained team and they have a great coach. Another thought is I would like to see Cujo in for Torres next time. Hashtag free Cujo. And my final thought is players are now taking a well-deserved break. So I hope they go and re-energize. They go out there and reset and just be ready for the next game, which is July 2nd. Hopefully a little break will help them come back focused and stronger.
Yeah. I think the biggest positive from this match is Tucker's play. I mean, wow. I think we found Tucker's position at this level. I think Tucker from wide spots was just gliding past defenders. It's a different kind of pace. Like Paige on the other side gets by defenders, but it looks as though she's working really hard to accomplish that. With Tucker, it just looks effortless. So that the first time she blew through two players, I was like, okay, all right. And then the second time, I was like, all right, all right. And then the third time, I was like, all right, maybe this is a thing now. So on top of that, she played some decent balls in. Really good performance from her with the international break and then us essentially losing our entire attack. This was a good chance for her to showcase and show that she deserves more minutes. And I say mission accomplished. She made the most of her minutes. I really liked her wide more than centrally. I think that's where she's going to be at this point.
Yeah, you're right. She definitely looked different on this game. She looked sharper. She was flying to the defenders when they needed her. And like you said, the players that came in the second half brought that spark, and she was just, honestly, she was shining out there, and I like that.
I also thought Didasco looked fantastic out there. This is the Didasco we've been missing all season. She was slicing up defenders. She was getting forward. I mean, excellent from her. 8 of 9 of her duels. She completed 100% of her tackles. She was awesome. And then lastly, this was the best version of Gotham we've seen all season, statistically speaking. Gotham was second best on the night. San Diego is just really well coached. They are patient in the attack. They're always sending secondary runners. And when you just have a player in his form as Morgan, you can just be patient. In a vacuum, this is not the worst performance. This break could not have come at a better time. This team needs to reset.
Yeah, definitely needs to reset. And if Gotham doesn't make it to the finals, I don't know. I think I'm going to have to root for San Diego because Sheridan's there. Gotham needs to do something now. I want to see them in the playoffs.
Yeah. So what is your stat of the week?
So stat of the week, San Diego players scored a 6.9 or above, and Alex Morgan with the highest rating of 9.2 on FUTMOB. And meanwhile, Gotham players scored between 5.2 and 7.3. Didasco being the player with the highest score from Gotham with that 7.3.
Yeah, that was pretty rough to look at.
Yeah.
My stat is pretty simple. Two big chances, and they scored on both their chances, and Gotham didn't score. End of story.
That's a stat.
Yep. Let's get to our players of the week over on Twitter at OverGothamPod. Fan chose Mewis as the winner with 40%, just edging out Caprice at 36%. Do you agree, Ruby?
My player of this week is Didasco. So Didasco earned the player of the week for me because she was straight hustling out there. I would see her in one place and I would literally blink. And then she was in another place right away. She was great for me.
Yeah, she was. Absolutely. Definitely between the two of them for me. I'm just going to go with Mewis because this is the Chrissy we were promised. She was threading balls through, and if Gotham could finish at all, she would have three assists. Let's look ahead to this break. This team definitely needs to reset. It is a good time for certain players that are in a funk to change their environment and challenge themselves internationally. This gives the coaching team time to reevaluate what works and what doesn't work. With so many Gotham attackers missing, it's going to be interesting to see what lineup formation this team uses come July. Before we get to moves this team can make, I'm curious your thoughts on the positives of coming out of this break, Ruby.
This is the time to go and re-energize, like focus. Like you said, too, go somewhere else, you know, change of scenery. I know some players are at the beach or some players are in Mexico and Cancun. So honestly, for now, take off soccer off your head. You know, if you keep thinking and you overthink it, it's not going to work out. So maybe taking that long break, coming back, re-energized, it's going to help the whole team and come back, you know, stronger and find that chemistry that's missing.
Let's talk about moves for this team. This is the international window opening up. So first, let's talk about coaching. There can be a case made for a coaching change. If you're going to do it, this would be the time to do it when the team is off for 2 weeks. That being said, you have to look at the ifs. You can compile a long list of ifs that can completely change the fortunes for Gotham this season. Most of these games have been 1-0 games. A ball bouncing in instead of off the post can mean the difference between Gotham being in the middle of the pack or top of the table. It is up to Yael to decide if the promise of those ifs are worth staying the course. I don't think Parkinson's system so far has gotten the best out of these players. Not even close. There does seem to be a struggle between what the players want to do and what Scott wants from them. I noticed in the post-game presser that Scott used the word there when talking about the issues in scoring, as in collective, as he's taking ownership of that. But when he talks about the team playing out of the back, he uses the word Gotham. Gotham likes to do that, as in that's what they want to do. So it seems to be this kind of give and take between what the players want to do and what he wants from them. Scott needs to figure this out. Do you coach these players the way they are, or do you keep seeing this divide all season? I'm not sure.
That's just weird. Like you say, well, Gotham likes to do that. If it's my team, I wouldn't talk about, well, Gotham likes to do that and be like, my team, our team likes to build from the back. I was not really convinced on a change of coaches, but it kind of becomes a little more evident now that it needs to happen if it's going to happen. Honestly, I don't think Yael's going to do that. I don't think they're going to fire Scott and bring someone else. I think Scott's going to stay. And hopefully, again, after this break, they come back energized, different mindset, and we see them winning.
It's frustrating as someone who's played soccer a long time that when you see things that are so close to happening, and you know that, again, we talk about the ifs. If a couple little things go differently, we're talking about a team at the top of the table versus a team middle of the pack that's slipping a little bit. This team still has a lot of games in hand. So you also, but that also means that once this break is over, those games are going to start coming pretty quickly. So this is a team that needs to gel quickly or it's going to be a really big rough patch. But let's talk about player moves for this team. This team needs to make a move. They will have the roster space for at least one move with Gina retiring. What I would like to see of this team is to, I would like to see this team offer a low round draft choice to OL for either Watt or King, shore up some of our attacking depth. I don't think OL even has a draft pick at this point at the rate they're bringing in players. So those are two talented players that could add a boost to this offense. I would also like to see this team move Cujo. I mean, honestly, what is the point anymore? Jennifer has value and she's taken up an international spot. When players like Baxter have moved ahead of her, I think it's time to move on. I mean, no offense to Baxter. I just think about how far Jennifer has fallen from the pecking order. I mean, she used to be a starter. Now there's like 4 or 5 players more that are seemingly ahead of her. That would open up resources for a bigger move. And according to Jenna's sources, both Visco and Bike, the two trialists from the beginning of the season, are still in training with the team. So maybe one of them gets the nod. Visco is a center back out of Rutgers, and Jenna Bike is a forward out of Boston College. What do you think you want to see, Ruby?
So I did see on social media that Jenna Bike, she is training. I think I saw it on Cujo's story or something like that. I honestly would like to see Bike come into the team, bring something new to the team. And like you said, too, I definitely have to agree with you. If Scott's not going to give playtime to Cujo, just move her, because if she's not even dressing up. Well, lately she's been dressing up. But if you're not playing, coaches and other players are going to forget about you. So she does have value because she's such a great player. And she showed that throughout the Challenge Cup in 2020 and throughout 2021. She's a great talent. So it will be nice for Scott to let her go and let her actually get some minutes in another team. Because again, if you're not playing, coaches are going to forget about you. And I don't think she deserves that. She deserves to be playing. Hashtag free Cujo.
I want to point out that I'm not fully on the coaching change thing. I just wanted to present a case scenario why that might happen. Right now, Gotham ends up in eighth place with 9 points from 7 games. 9 points from first place now with 3 games in hand on the leader, San Diego. What do you think, Ruby?
I don't know. Anything is possible. Anything is possible at this point. If Gotham starts taking advantage of their games and starts getting some points, they could be in first place. I don't want to jinx them, though.
So we have a break, so no preview of the opponent's section. However, we will be back next week with a special show as we'll get caught up on our national team players, and we'll have a special interview to share with you. As we talked earlier, Stephanie Savino from Morris Elite is amazing, and I can't wait to share her interview with you. So that's going to be good. So the USLW League, it's just a game changer for women's soccer. So for a million reasons, which we're going to get into. So I would like to start a friendly rivalry with Gotham FC fans as we support our local W League teams. There's a bunch of them across New Jersey and New York. So I know Jenna supports Queensboro. I think I've chosen one, I think. But I know Ruby's going to be, you're supporting Morris Elite, are you not?
Yes, I am. So I live in Morristown, so I'm rooting for Morris Elite, which is my local soccer team here. I'm rooting for them, and I'm planning to go one of their games. Their next game, well, the next home game's July 2nd, but Gotham also has a game that day, so probably not going to go to that one. But then their next home game will be July 9th against Queensboro, so I'll be there supporting Morris Elite.
We got a great interview with Dan Laletta coming up, but let's do some manifesting session. What do we manifest over the break?
Oh, manifesting. Anyone that's hurt right now to heal, come back healed, because we're going to need all the woman power while international break is going on. We need them all to come healthy and help the team win.
I'm manifesting this team come out of the other side of this break with a collective identity ready to go. Yeah. So any random thoughts before we go?
I don't have any random thoughts this week. I think my random thought was that French fry thing that happened to me. Yeah. Can I get my French fries? I'm happy to see those long lines. It was long, long lines. I honestly went all around the stadium looking like maybe if I keep walking, I'm going to find one that's not that long. But they were all long. And that's nice to see the people showing up for Gotham.
Today was the season finale of the Obi-Wan show. So I'm excited.
Talking about shows, I don't know if you've been watching the Umbrella Academy. New season came out. Oh,
you know, I forgot about that show. Then Alana was like, this is coming out today. And I'm like, oh, wow, I remember that show. I was like, all right, yeah, we're probably going to binge it this weekend.
It's so good. And the cool thing is that it's still June, which is Pride Month. And they have a character, he started as Venya, and now he is Victor. So that's pretty cool to see his story in this series. So anyone that wants to watch The Umbrella Academy, go watch it. I recommend it.
Absolutely. We're going to go talk to Dan Laletta, shall we?
Let's go.
All right, fans. Our next guest is one of the top journalists in women's soccer. He writes for The Equalizer. Welcome to the podcast, Dan Laletta.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So I'm so excited for this interview because obviously, you've been a top soccer writer and content producer for years. And as we talked about earlier, I'm a sports communication major. I know there's a lot I can learn from you, so I can't wait to get into this. Real quick questions for you, so I know you are from New York. Mets or Yankees?
Mets, all the way.
Gotcha. Knicks or Nets?
Neither. Miami Heat, actually, believe it or not.
Gotcha. So men's soccer, is New York blue, red, or Cosmo green?
Ooh, that is a good question. That is a tough question. You have to say blue because, you know, the Red Bulls are the New York Red Bulls, but they never really had a lot of ties to New York, have they?
No, not really.
So we'll go with blue.
All right. So who was the first professional player you interviewed?
First professional player I interviewed was, I guess it was pre-professional league, but I think it was Sarah Whalen, who was on the 1999 World Cup team and is almost exactly my age and grew up maybe 15 or 20 minutes from me. So when she was first starting out on the national team, I was doing some college radio, and they were all too happy to set me up with an interview with Sarah Whalen.
Yeah. So what is the last book you read?
The last book I read was The Giver, which is actually a young adult book. But yeah, The Giver.
Okay. And what outside of sports are you nerdy about? Like what are you an expert in outside of sports?
I can name you all the presidency of the United States and year served. How about that?
Yeah, I'm not going to ask you to do that, but
yeah, please don't.
Absolutely. So tell us a little about the Equalizer and its mission. So how did you end up writing there and how did it get started?
Well, the Equalizer started, I believe, in 2009 by Jeff Kasouf, who wanted to essentially fill a void, which was a space to cover women's soccer and to do it, quote unquote, the right way by actually giving the sport real hard coverage instead of, you know, patting everybody on the back and, you know, isn't this wonderful, which of course it is wonderful, but, you know, I think it needed and probably still does need a little bit more of the hard coverage. And that was 2009 when WPS was launching and it was a good time for that. I joined up unofficially around 2010. And then I guess when I was set to do more for them after the 2011 season, but then the WPS was no more. And then in the summer of 2012 was when there was like this weird announcement right before the Olympic gold medal game about a new league. And that turned out to be NWSL, but wasn't really the announcement for NWSL. But from that point forward, Jeff and I and a couple of others, one of them actually is Meg Linehan, who is now very prominent at The Athletic. You know, we formulated a plan from there to kind of cover the NWSL, and I've been involved ever since. But it's, you know, essentially the mission is to cover women's soccer and to do it the right way.
Yeah. And how did you get started in covering soccer in general? Were you a soccer player? And how did you know that soccer journalism was for you?
Was definitely not a player. I stopped playing soccer when they made the field bigger, which was when I was about 8, because I didn't want to do all the running. So,
right.
I mean, you know, I mentioned before, neither Knicks nor Nets, Miami Heat. And part of the reason that I'm a Miami Heat fan is because I wanted to follow a sports team from its inception. Next league to expand was the NBA. And for whatever reason, I picked the Heat over the Hornets. And sort of the same thing for soccer. You know, I remember watching the World Cup in 1999, and I knew about the women's national team, and it was pretty cool. And it was really cool to see how they captured the attention of the country that summer. And then the following summer, I went into a bookstore and I read Girls of Summer by Yuri Longman, which was about that 1999 team. Highly recommended read, by the way. Easy read and really gets into some of the history of all 20 players on that team. Happy that I didn't have to say that was the last book I read. I have read a couple since then. But essentially, from that, a league got started, which was the WUSA. And one of the teams played 15 or 20 minutes away from where I lived. And I was young and kind of aimless, so I was able to give some time to it. And I wound up sending some emails out and happened to get a bite from someone who was on the verge of getting the contract to write for WUSA.com. So it just kind of spawned from there. And I've been involved in it on some level, you know, some days, some years more so than others, but on some level I've been involved in it, I guess, ever since then.
So why women's soccer?
You know, I got into soccer when Major League Soccer came to the US. You know, I watched the World Cup a little bit, but honestly, no specific reason. You know, it's a sport. It was a sport that had roots, and I like the idea of being there from the beginning. I don't think that I have any special, you know, affection for soccer over other sports. I certainly watch more soccer probably than most others, but it honestly, it could have been any sport. I really enjoy having been there from the nascent days of the professional league. So that's really my main motivation in that regard.
And now that you've been in this world for a little while, what do you think your role is as a man covering women's sports?
That's a good question, because I don't think that was necessarily something that was even discussed for the first 10 or 15 years, even really into the beginning of the NWSL. What I would hope, honestly, is that my role as a man covering women's soccer is very much the same as a woman covering men's soccer or any men's sport. You know, we're all out there because we enjoy doing it and because we're trying to give the league coverage. And I think for the most part, these things, you know, shouldn't necessarily matter. And, I don't know how much that is the case in reality, but that's my personal feeling on it. You know, as I'm trying to cover the sport just like anybody else, and, you know, male, female doesn't really make a difference to me.
Indeed. So for those who don't know, you were actually the one who, quote, broke the story on Elise LaHue being absent from the team at Gotham. So walk us through that as a journalist's perspective. So as you're getting this information, you have to be correct, you have to be responsible, but, you know, everybody wants to be first. But walk us through, what did you know and how that went down?
Yeah, being first is a catch 22 these days, right? Because, right, you know, sometimes these things literally can be minutes or seconds apart. That was an interesting one because there weren't a lot of details, and there still really aren't a lot of details, correct, about that particular situation. But it just came to my attention one day that she had been away from the team. And if I recall correctly, I believe that I reached out to her and she sent back something extremely vague, which was the last time that I had heard from her. And, you know, it became apparent, you know, from enough different sources that she was not with the team. And so, you know, we just went with that. You know, there wasn't a lot to it. Obviously, there still hasn't been a big expose written about it. I don't know that there is going to be one. She's been pretty quiet now. It's been, what, I guess, a year or more. Around that sometime, I know part of that story went down in June of last year, so it's been about a year. But yeah, you know, I am a big believer that you need to be right, you know, over being first, and I'd rather have someone else get it first than me taking the chance about being wrong about something. You know, I've been wrong about nothing that big, but everybody who breaks news occasionally gets something a little bit off, and it's a pretty lousy feeling, and it's not something that you really want to do very often.
Yeah. And that was essentially the first domino in a seemingly long line of firings, investigations that are still ongoing. So as someone who's covered women's soccer for so long, I'm guessing you were probably the least surprised by all this. But so what's your take on that craziness that was last year?
Well, I don't know that we've really gotten to the bottom of it yet, right? Because we're still this year, you know, James Clarkson and Amanda Cromwell have been put on leave for things that are a lot more vague than certainly a lot of, you know, that was more like an Elise situation where, you know, an Elise didn't have to be announced the same way the others did because she wasn't the visual coach of the team. So they were able to kind of sit on that and hide it a little bit for a bit longer. But, you know, obviously, you know, with some of the stuff that happened with Paul Riley and Richie Burke and Rory Dames, you know, that stuff is a lot more front and center. It's pretty clear to me from seeing that and from talking to other people that this is something that is embedded with, and I don't want to say it's embedded in women's soccer because, you know, look at what's happened with USA Gymnastics and there's, right, you see it across sports. I think it is an issue with the way youth sports in our country is sort of structured in that, you know, parents just turn their kids over to the local coach and say, you know, make my kid a star or get my kid a college scholarship. And I'm certainly not blaming parents for this, but I think we need to look at everything here as a whole. But, you know, I'm not sure because I don't know much about the current situation. So have we overcorrected and now we are haphazardly suspending coaches because of some accusations before we look into it enough? You know, I'm not sure. So I don't know that we're to the end of it. I'd like to think that the worst of it is behind us. I certainly hope that it is. But I, you know, it's a tenuous time, to be honest, to be working in the NWSL right now.
Yeah. And obviously the big thing that happened was the CBA. What is something that really jumps out at you about the CBA that you think is so absolutely necessary?
Well, first of all, just that they got it accomplished, because once you get the CBA accomplished, you know, the free agency bit is not really a big deal in terms of, you know, what the players are going to get paid and when players are going to be able to become free agents. But once you get that on the table, once you get that into your league, then you can build on that. You know, when MLS finally got free agency, I don't know, 5-6 years ago, whatever it was, and a lot of people say, well, it's free agency, but it's terrible because they have to wait 7 or 8 years, whatever it is, but they got it in. So now it's in, you can continue to negotiate off of that. So I think just the fact that there now is a CBA, that the players have some representation and that the players can, you know, I think it's overstated sometimes about how much the players need in terms of their rights. I mean, they need fundamental rights, but there's, you know, but you know, it is still a professional sports league. You're still going to get, you know, traded and cut or whatever on your own merits. But I think it's important for the players not to just be in a league where the league says, well, if we do this, we might fold. So we're going to have to not pay you for this or not pay you for that. So now there are, you know, there are a lot of stipulations in there that just allow the players to have a fairly comfortable life as they, you know, attempt to be professional athletes. You know, the league now is fully professional, you know, year round housing is pretty huge deal. So, you know, I think it's a step in the right direction. There is a long, long way to go, but it's certainly a step in the right direction.
And what would you say what is your vision for women's soccer of the future?
My vision for women's soccer that I hope that it can get to is where it can be like, you know, for the most part, like other mainstream sports, you know, that you can walk down the street in Kansas City and hear somebody say, you know, I can't believe the Current lost that game. You know, why is Matt Potter playing player X over here? Or why did he sub on this player in the 72nd minute? Or what took him so long to do that? And to have people at the games and have the fans be passionate. And I think ultimately we need to flip the script and make it so that the clubs are what drive players as they're growing up and becoming professionals. And it's understandable why the national team has driven that bus for such a long time, but it needs to be now, because, you know, now this league is in year 10, right? So you're, you know, first we had the two leagues that were 3 years each. Then we finally got a group where say, hey, this draft class went to school and the league that existed when they were freshmen is still around. Then you got kids who went to high school when this league was around and they're coming out and they're playing in the league. So if you can eventually get kids growing up and realizing that, hey, my local team, that's who I want to play for. Like, if I can make the national team and play in a World Cup, that would be spectacular. But I want to play for the Current or the Rain or the Pride or whoever. And I think if we can flip the script and then make it so that it's more lucrative, like on, you know, I mean, most men's players play for their club team. I'd say even all men's players play for their club team a lot longer than their national team because it's A, more prestigious or as prestigious, and they make a pretty good living doing it. So I think we need to get to that point in the women's game, rather than basing it off the national team and then spawning it out to clubs. We need to make the clubs the big focus and then spawn that out to the national team.
Yeah. And it's speaking of that dichotomy. So the MLS just signed a large deal with Apple TV, 10 years, which is unheard of. So the NWSL is getting near those ratings. So do you think like the next streaming war is going to be for NWSL? And do you think they're going to get that kind of a contract?
It doesn't appear that way because I just doesn't appear yet that the people making these decisions, and I mean the people in the boardrooms of the networks or the streaming services, have kind of figured out women's sports. Like, I think they're on board with big women's sporting events like World Cups. I don't know if you remember the U.S. Women's Golf Open in 2020 was in December. During COVID, and it was just like a lost weekend on the sports calendar, and it blew up. Everybody was suddenly following women's golf for a weekend. But again, big event, right? Week to week, nobody really talks about the LPGA. So I don't know that we're there yet on the, you know, week to week with the NWSL, but, you know, hopefully they can continue to build on the product that they put out and put a little bit more resources into it. And, you know, I know one of, you know, in full disclosure, I'm part of the broadcast team for the NWSL. And I know that NWSL fans, one of their favorite pastimes is criticizing the broadcast, often with legitimate critiques. But, you know, there needs to be more resources put in to enable those broadcasts to be better than they are right now. And trust me, people who are working on them, talent and behind the scenes are working as hard as you want them to work, but there needs to be some more resources put in there at some point.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's switch gears a little bit. Let's talk a little about Gotham FC. So as a journalist, what would you say the narrative is surrounding this team at the moment?
On the field or off the field?
On the field.
On the field. I'm curious why they can't create more chances. They have more attacking talent than shows up when they play, right? Like they got those three goals against Orlando on week one. And I think it was the week before that, right? They played them in the Challenge Cup and they didn't, yeah. I think it was 1-1, but they absolutely dominated the second half of that game. They haven't had enough stretches where they've dominated games and they haven't scored enough goals. And I don't know why that is. And I know Scott Parkinson talks about, you know, playing the tiki-taka soccer, but that they need to make the more forward pass. And they're sometimes they make the more conservative pass rather than getting firmly into the attack. You know, I wonder, do they miss Carly Lloyd and Allie Long more than it appears? You know, Carly Lloyd didn't light up the score sheet, but she certainly attracted attention and certainly brought an intensity to the pitch. You know, Allie Long's absence has kind of forced McCall Zerboni into a bit of a different role and taking on a little bit more responsibility. And I know I'm probably on dangerous ground with the audience you have, but, you know, I think maybe McCall starting to show her age just a little teeny bit this year. So, they got to figure out how to get up into the attack and get some goals. And you need, I feel like most teams, you need to have games or stretches where you're not totally pressed. And when, you know, unless you talk about the San Diego game when they lost 4-0 and they were, you know, it was essentially playing it out for the last 20, 30 minutes, you know, you don't want to always be in these super tight games where you're scrapping for every inch of ground. You know, you want to win some games, 2-0, 3-0, be able to take off a player that usually goes 90 minutes and whatnot. I think long term, that could be a problem. But I think the big thing is they need to figure out how to get more out of their attack, because they certainly, if you look at up and down the roster, they have the players that are capable of unlocking defenses in the NWSL.
Yeah, I agree. Shrugging my shoulders the entire time. I have no idea.
Pretty much.
Yeah. The New York sports market it's a tough one. So what do you think Gotham can do to attract more of that market space?
Gee, if I had the answer to that question, I'd be working for the team because, you know, you go back to 96 was the Metro Stars and then the Liberty in 97. You know, and the Liberty were in the finals four of the first 6 years of the WNBA, and they were fun to watch. And they had Rebecca Lobo and they had some other really exciting players, you know, the Witherspoons. Nobody cared. And that's not trying to speak down about the WNBA. Like, they had their fan base, they were passionate, and the women's basketball fans cared, but they did not permeate the New York market one iota. So the answer is, to be completely honest, I don't know. You know, I thought back when the Red Bulls and NYCFC started their rivalry, you know, maybe they could get a back page on a newspaper once, just when they played their Hudson River Derby. But, you know, we'd rather ruminate about, you know, the Mets and Yankees bullpen selections, you know, for another game. So I don't know. You know, the David Beckham factor for Major League Soccer can't be underrated. I don't know that really resonated in New York, other than when he came to Giant Stadium and they got 70 something thousand. And, you know, I think what did the Metro Star or Red Bulls, I guess at that time, won 5-4, but that didn't really create a lot of buzz around the team other than that one evening. So I really wish I could answer that question, but I don't know the answer.
Yeah. We ended up talking last season to Shep Messing, who's obviously probably the only person who knows more about New York soccer than you do. So I asked him.
Well, he certainly knows more than me. I'll say that for sure.
He's a wonderful guest. He's a really fun, really fun person. Yeah. And so I was talking to him and I asked him the same question. I was like, what do they got to do? And he said, basically, when New York wants a winner, they have to win. But then New York City won, they're attendance isn't really much any better than it was last season. Maybe a little bit better, but.
And they just changed coaches, and that's not making really an imprint around here. You know, it's a big deal in MLS circles, of course, and in soccer circles since you went back to Europe, but it's not. Yeah, I agree. It's just not a, it's not as big a deal as it probably should be. You know, to give, you know, when I was in 2009, when Sky Blue FC, right now Gotham, and I always had an issue with that name because, you know, nothing against the name itself, but you want to have a name that resonates for people who don't know that there's a league. Like, you want people to be able to pick up the newspaper or whatever it is nowadays and say, oh, there's a team in my city, but Sky Blue FC didn't really get that done. But anyway, I was in Los Angeles when they played in the final. And at the time, I was what you might call a full-time freelancer for one of the local newspapers, not doing soccer, but I had done a little bit of soccer. And I basically called the sports editor and said, hey, I'm in California. I'm at the game. All you have to do is pay me to write the story and I will cover the game for you. And this was the final. And they said, no, thank you. They didn't want the final covered by someone, you know, and again, they knew me, I was on the payroll. So they would have, it would have cost them like $100, whatever they were paying me. And they didn't want to do it.
Wow. That's crazy. So, but you also covered the national team as well. So tell us about going to, I think you went to France. You went to France yourself and covered them there. Yeah. What was that like?
France was pretty cool. Well, I would say France was pretty cool, but it was like 105 degrees at the coolest point because there was a humongous heat wave that week. Covering the World Cup is pretty cool. You know, I was in Canada a little bit also. I didn't do the entire World Cup, but I did quarterfinals and onward in both cases. And it's, you know, it's really cool. It is, there's just a lot of people there who are really into the game and into the tournament. And it's, you know, that I was actually in the stands for the US-France quarterfinal. And it was really interesting because it was probably, I would say it was like 55-45 French fans, but the US fans were louder till the end of the game when France pulled the goal back. Then it looked like they might tie it up and then they really got into it. And that's just not something you see a lot in the women's game. So the World Cup is fun. I will not be attending next year, but I'll probably regret it when it comes around and I'm not there. But yeah, I recommend the World Cup as a trip for anybody, whether as a journalist or a fan or whatnot, because it's really amazing to be consumed by soccer, especially if you're in, you know, if it's women's soccer and there's not as many options for that. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah. And speaking of the current national team, that there's a youth movement going on in both the men and the women's team. So how do you feel? Was it necessary? Do you feel like what do you think of the team as a whole as far as the youth movement?
It's always necessary, I think, in national teams to have youth movements because you can just get stagnant with the older players. Now, this has been such a weird cycle because when Vlatko Andonovski came in, he was supposed to get through the 2020 Olympics and then kind of flip over the roster and have a long time to do it. Well, 2020, they barely played after the She Believes Cup. And then the Olympics got pushed back to 2021. So he didn't have the same kind of flexibility. But, you know, if you remember, there was some point where Jill Ellis talked about the end of the 100 cap player, because that if players got to 100 caps, it would mean they weren't doing a good enough job at pushing them out from behind. And, you know, I don't know that the number necessarily matters, but I do think it's important to continue to push players. I think the end of the contract status for these national team players is going to be huge because it will now be a much more merit-based system week to week, month to month, and that the club form will actually really matter. I know some people might be saying, well, then why is Megan Rapinoe in there? And that's maybe a fair point. But, you know, I think the youth movement was necessary. I think at one point there were maybe too many players on the team that were, you know, I don't want to say too old because, you know, if you're good enough, you're good enough. But and they did win the last two World Cups, so it's not like they're, you know, they're doing anything wrong here. But yeah, you always have to continue to bring in the young players. If you look at like a Mallory Pugh, Sophia Smith, Trinity Rodman, like if those three can click on the front line, I mean, who's the oldest player in that group? Is what, 22 maybe?
Yeah, maybe.
So, you know, it's pretty remarkable. So there, you know, the youth is there, but you know, we will see what happens. I'd be interested to see if Andonovski can pull this off.
Yeah, because I think of like on the men's side, there was a missing gap of players where they just were not like the players on this team now, where are the players from like 28 to like 32-ish on the men's side?
Yeah, I mean, I don't follow the men's team nearly as close, but that, I mean, there's your 2018 non-World Cup right. cycle, right? Is they kind of missed a cycle, missed a generation there.
Yeah, so like you can't do that. So I'm glad that they are keeping the young players involved and getting them going. And yeah, I'm excited for this qualifying. Are you?
I'm going to be honest with you. I don't get excited about qualifying because it is such an utter formality for the U.S. to qualify. I mean, you know, it's very cool to see some of the lesser teams that are on CONCACAF play, and now there are more spots in the World Cup, which I don't love. So I'm in the minority about this, but I am not jazzed up for qualifying. You know, I'll watch it when it comes along. But I would prefer we get into a system. I wrote a column about this a few years ago that I think FIFA needs to really hold the confederation's feet to the fire and get them, you know, not instantly, but some sort of a rolling scenario where by a certain cycle, the women are playing proper qualifiers. Like the men, because look at Europe. Like there are good teams in Europe that won't make the World Cup because it's actually difficult to get in because they play proper qualifiers. And what does that do? It allows the teams that aren't very good to get good quality games in. And I understand that, you know, we're maybe not going to go to, like, it's weird enough when the men go to like St. Kitts and play there. And so the women's team is probably way further behind than the men's team even, but there's got to be some strides made to make these qualifiers actually interesting, right? Like, you know, we don't want to say, well, it's good that the men didn't qualify in 2018, but it was interesting, right? So, you know, do I think the women are not qualify? No, they're going to qualify handily. Now, the Olympic spot, that's a little bit interesting because they have to win this to guarantee that they're in, and if not, they get into a playoff. And I don't like the double dipping there, but, you know, that's a whole other conversation to be had. But then again, now that said, very excited to see some of these young players and how they do. But in terms of, you know, I mean, their first game is against Haiti on July 4th, I think. So how do we think that one's going to go?
Yeah, pretty well for us, I'm sure. Very good. So I have one more question for you, Dan. When am I going to see you at a Gotham game?
That is a good question. You know, there was a time I went to the mall, mm-hmm. and then we had a little thing called the pandemic, and we started getting on Zoom calls, and I would like it to happen at some point this season, but I'm not gonna hold myself to any specific dates or times on that one.
Yeah. All right. So that is our show for the week. We will be back next Thursday. As always, we have a special show during next week's break. We are going to take a deep dive into the USLW League with Morris Elite head coach Stephanie Savino. It's time we Gotham fans start getting a friendly rivalry within picking our USLW League teams. I don't have one yet. Let's see if Stephanie can convince me to root for Morris Elite. So final thought, the USLW League is super important to the future of American women's soccer. I can't wait to learn more. Dan, thank you for coming on. This has been enlightening for me, and I've learned so much, and I can't wait to be you someday.
Glad to be here anytime.
All right. So for Dan, Ruby, and myself, thanks everybody for listening. We will see you on the next one.